calm the bringer of the questions. Very good. Very good. Okay. I'll do it upside down this time. Here we go. Very good. Very good. It's quite hard to discern the difference between habit, laziness, and the body's real need in relation to sleep, and how much is right for us. It's also easy to feel some guilt, or like one's not quite there yet, where the retreat schedule sets the idea of rising with gusto at 4 to 4:30 a.m. Any suggestions on this? You know, 4:30. You know, it is New Zealand time. What time is 4:30 in New Zealand? That's about right, isn't it?
Yeah, three that's right.
It's about later on. So it is the case that well, maybe we should actually take that thing down. The that retreat schedule, that was a long time ago we had that on there. All you really need to know is breakfast time, morning talk, lunch, and interviews, you can't put that on the schedule, interviews sometime, and also the evening question and answer. That's all you really need to do. The schedule is a guideline. You don't get excommunicated, executed, thrown out of this retreat if you break this schedule, because these rules are for you. It's not that you're for the rules. In other words, I don't know how many people I've seen on their mobile phones already or talking. Because of course you can cheat, of course you can do these things. But do you really want to? It has to be for you to get that self-discipline. Discipline from the outside, you know, somebody, the mobile phone police, they're going around with a camera and, you know, with a tracker so I can find who's on the phone right now, or just CCTV cameras in your rooms. Well, apparently we can do this now, apparently, with this hearing aid thing. It can give you a signal in the rooms. So it's a very simple from there to put in a, wake up! at 4 o'clock in each of your rooms, in your cottages. But is that really what you should be doing? Because I grew up with a lot of discipline in Wat Pa Prong. You know, you had to get up 3 o'clock in the morning. And if you didn't make it to the morning meeting, then you couldn't eat that day. Or you couldn't make it for the, not making it for the arms round, then you wouldn't be able to eat that day. You only eat once a day. That was pretty tough. So there's lots of stuff like that. But what I found was that the monks would get up there just to eat, but as soon as they left to go, you know, whether it's going off to do your visas in another monastery, or you went on the Tudong, they just fell apart. Because it was just the external discipline which actually made you do things. And then a lot of times the monks, oh, I'm sick, I can't get up in the morning. And, you know, sometimes was it really sick, or was it they didn't really want to get up? So, you know, sometimes it was a little bit unconvincing that rising up at 4 to 4:30, if you want to, fine. But you don't have to. It's just a guideline. Because throughout your whole life, sometimes people are telling you, you have to do this, you have to do that, and living up by other people's rules and expectations. That's why there is no wake-up bell in the morning. First retreats where I went to, there'd be people coming around, ding, 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 around all the rooms at North Perth Centre, or even before that, somebody would be the bell person. They were the most hated person in the whole retreat to get that duty. And then you think there's something wrong with that. And so that's where we started the old bad joke coming. the Nobel silence. Yeah, come on. I know it's late. No bells. And that's such a wonderful thing that when you'd first tried that, no bells, that you found that people would actually get up earlier and they'd stay later. The reason was because sometimes, you know, you're tired, you had a busy day or something, or, you know, you don't feel good. So you go to bed early. And just straight after the talk, or in the middle of the talk, I don't care, it's all recorded. And you go and have a rest. And then, because you're tired, and then you get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and what do you think? Say, oh, it's not 4:30 yet. Gusto hasn't arrived. But you think, oh, I feel okay. So you just get up 3 o'clock in the morning. You don't look at the clock. You get up at 3 o'clock, and you start meditating, and then you can, you know, there's no shame. You can meditate at 3 or 4 o'clock, and okay, I'm tired now. Then go to bed at 5. And you'd always wake up for breakfast. That you never need an alarm. So what it really means, but I remember this, that when I was meditating, you know, doing retreats, then it came to about 9, 9:30, and you really were getting, you know, really good in your meditation. You were very peaceful. Things were happening. And then, should I carry on? Oh no, I've got to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Otherwise Ajahn Chah will turn me off. Imagine that. Imagine the Buddha under the Bodhi tree, and he was meditating, and then it came to 9, 10 o'clock, you know, the limiters were coming up, and he said, oh my goodness, I've got to get up tomorrow morning, I better take a rest now. You get the message, don't you? We have to keep it natural, because there were some times when I was on this meditate when I was still a layperson, meditation retreats, they had the bell. And I was sitting there, and you know, my legs were killing me, just really restless. It was just wasn't working. And I thought, when is that teacher going to ring that damn bell? Come on, it must be half an hour. It must be 45 minutes. Come on, come on. I started thinking, maybe the clock has stopped. Maybe it needs some more batteries. I'm really stuffed. It may be, you know, it's only supposed to be an hour meditation. Maybe it's at least an hour and a half now. Maybe they made a mistake. Maybe the teacher was like that monk in the Vietnam. Well, I'll give him a name. He was a monk in Sydney who actually did 8 days. Imagine that. You know, they had to wait 8 days until the bell rang. So sometimes I was really up. So I formed this sneaky idea. I'm full of sneaky ideas. Was to get one of the slingshots. And I practiced first of all, so it was a good shot. And then when the teacher goes, Ajahn Chah would have his eyes closed. And then he'd go, bong! If I didn't tell you what's going on, we'd all bow and be out of there. I never had the guts and courage to do it, but I thought about it. Or sometimes, oh, you know, you're sitting there getting really peaceful. Oh, this is really nice. And then, gong! And that's the end of the meditation. And you have to keep it natural. There are some times when it's not the right causes and conditions to do a long meditation. And at other times when you're really into it, and yeah, go for it. Just no bells, no disturbance, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours. You know, I tell this, you know, to the monks, Sunya will tell you this, but if, you know, you get into sort of a jhana, just carry on. But just, you know, if you miss the breakfast, I will take you. Now, I'll order in your favorite food. Get it sort of delivered to your door. Pizza delivery or whatever. Don't worry about the food, because you really want to make sure you get into good meditation. So, that's one of the most important things. There was, I don't know if this, you believe this story, but it's in one of the suttas. There was a monk, and he was meditating early, meditating most of the night. And early in the morning, he was just that close to enlightenment. Really, really close. But then, you know, the sun was going to come up soon, and he would have to do his duty to go an alms round. And so, I think the Buddha used the psychic power, but they actually stopped the sun for half an hour, just, you know, so that monk could actually just go to become enlightened. And that morning, sort of all the farmers wondering, it's a bit late, you know, should the sun come up now? You should be out to work now. What's going on? The sun hasn't come up yet. It doesn't feel right. And he did that because we'll do anything. You know, even just mess around with the clock, with the dates, just to make sure the person had that just extra time ready to get the breakthrough. And whether that story was true or not, at least it shows just how far you would go to make sure you have all the time and all the conditions right just to make these amazing deep meditations in enlightenment. Not bells controlling, but letting you take the meditation as deep as you possibly can. So that's why if you see someone here and they're meditating really peaceful and it's their lunchtime, don't tap them on the shoulder. Let them carry on meditating. You can actually see that they're sitting up very peaceful. If you see them like this, then you can tap them on the shoulder, because that's not jhana. But you can actually see them. They're just really still, very peaceful, powerful, and then leave them there. And if you know they need to get something to eat because they've got some stomach problems, don't worry. In that case, if you just come out of jhana, if you want to, you can have whatever food you like from the kitchen. Anything. I'd even cook it for you myself if you trust my cooking, which I've never done for years. But you know, that is the length, you know, you'd go to make sure that those things happen. And so when I experimented with this, what I found out, if we had schedules, when it got to 9 o'clock, most people would actually be gone to bed, so they can get up for 4 o'clock. We had no schedules, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock. There's always somebody staying in here. And some people in here at 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock. It was natural. They knew they didn't have to worry that if they meditated to 10, 11, 12 o'clock, they could always catch up when they sleep tomorrow. Or if they felt tired, they can get up early. And they're just early is really great because early in the morning it's cool, not many people here. It's very, very serene. So use the schedule, don't be afraid of it. And I found you got many more hours of meditating from people, and they didn't feel scared ready to meditate later on. So, and habit and laziness, if it really is laziness, you know, the body feels yucky. But if it is actually really asking, you know, body, how are you going? Do you want to go further? Yeah, go further. And sometimes you soon get mindful and understand your body and your mind enough. So you just ask the question, how do you feel? Yeah, no, I'm a bit tired. So go and take a rest. Sometimes you look at your body and, no, you know, this is good. So you stay and you get into deep meditation. Anyway, dear Ajahn, I read about a monk in Thailand who did walking meditation extensively. He did it day in, day out. He slept on the path. using his fist as a pillow. Finally became so depart on high results. Question, did he on anyone get jhana doing walking meditation? Know what he did, because I know that monk. At least I knew him, he's passed away now. So that was what's his name? Ajahn. We've got a picture of him on there, it's another. And it's not the Ajahn Dun who's still alive, it's another Ajahn Dun. I went to go and see him once with Ajahn Thuy in Nong Khai province. A really nice monk, obviously. But what he did, that he was from the northeast, and he was just doing some business up in Sakonakon. And that was when Ajahn Mun's funeral was being done. And because he realized that there was a big lot of monks around, he went to listen. And he got a lot of faith. And the only thing he remembered from the sermon was sit a lot and walk a lot. And that was it. That was his Dhamma teaching. And so he went off and eventually ordained, and that was all he learned about meditation. So he would just walk on a walking path, and when he got tired he would sit. And he'd get up and walk. And when he got tired, he would cross his legs and sit there on the path. And when he really got tired, he lay down and take a rest. And that was all he ever did. He was really cool monk, because one day we're talking with him, and just, I think it was Ajahn Jnana was there at the time, Ajahn Jnana Dhamma. Ajahn Jnana Dhamma, he said, "Oh, you know, where have you come from?" He said, "Oh, we came from Australia." "Oh, where is that?" He said, "Oh, it's down south." I said, "Oh, really? Now, what's the weather like down there?" "Well, you know, in the north of Australia, it's warm. You go further south, it's quite cool. If you go even further south, it's all just ice. It's Antarctica." He said, "Oh, that's really interesting." And the following morning, you know, he said, "Oh, yeah, you know, you're right. You know, there's lots of icebergs and really cold down there." He went to check it out. So this was like a monk, and it's only just, he was never actually really famous, because he kept it quiet. And in the village, he was just like this little old monk. They're very simply in the hut, would just go, you know, walking for alms and come back again and just sit down. No one knew who he was. I always liked that idea. Real holy monks, no one knows who they are. They could be sitting right next to me now. And that's exactly what they would do. They would deny it. Okay, yeah. So don't go around saying they're enlightened. But that was actually an interesting story. But all it was, he kept it so simple. We have so many instructions these days, which is sometimes it just complicates our mind. So that's what he did, sitting, and soon, because he wasn't doing anything else, he soon got into some really, really deep meditations. So he still did the jhanas, but I was sitting down. In meditation, what is the difference between joy and rapture? It is indistinguishable until, because they all go together, they're like inseparable twins, until the third jhana, when one of them disappears. That's the only time you can really understand the difference between joy and rapture. So what does rapture mean? It's a benefit of joy. It means it comes after this piti. But one of the things with this piti, that's in Sanskrit, is that many times it brings you to tears. Now, the tears of joy, inspiration. It's a beautiful Dhamma discourse. Oh, and just tears come. Oh, like those places, you know, in the world where they're just so powerful that, you know, people cry. And, I'll tell her name. You know, Barbara Ainsley? You know, she was from Devon. In England. And when we went on pilgrimage together, I told her the briefing before we left. "Oh, you know that some of these places are really powerful. You know, the Buddha lived there and I meditated there. There's some places they will really get you, have a huge power, and you feel it. So be, ready, to be really inspired." And apparently at the time I said, "In England, there's castles, there's ruins all over the place. It's only an old ruin, that's all." And because that's what she thought at the time. She never told me until afterwards. And the first day when she went into the Mahabodhi temple in Bodh Gaya, she wept. She really went for it. She wept. It's totally uncontrollable. And so she came to see me, that evening and asked forgiveness. She said, "Sorry, I thought you were a crazy monk. But, it happened to me just totally out of the blue, totally unexpected." Just wept with tears. Because this is a place where the Buddha became enlightened. It really got right into her. And just huge amounts of pity, not sadness, but just, wow, really joy. So if that happens to you in this meditation or anywhere else, you start crying, please go for it. We have heaps of tissues. And if the tissues don't work, we've got the toilet paper, which we have in abundance. It must be because of people, you know, you go over to Bodhinyana and see when people give offerings. They give so much toilet paper over there because I think they think we eat so much. And so they look at what's on the table and they realize that we've got this is what we have to give. Okay. Number two, my next question. So, how do I stop myself from hearing songs in my head while meditating? Is take your head off. Lobotomy? No. Now that sometimes they get in there, and if it's nice songs, that's really good. Get like this song. This is what should be done by one. That's a nice song. But they've probably got no control over that. So what happens is if you feed it negativity, it usually gets worse. So open the door of your heart.
My mouth.
Open the door of your heart to whatever's happening. Just relax and let it be. Don't try to get rid of it. If you try and get rid of it, then it's a problem. So if it's a nice song, just be with it. It's not you, it's not yours, it's just some sort of habit, that's all. Dear Ajahn Brahm, continuing from this morning's Dhamma talk, would you please combine the concept of non-inherent existence, water bottle, and impermanence. Non-inherent existence, water bottle, and impermanence. Just all this is, all this water bottle was just learning how to see beyond what you've been taught. Just like that story, it was funny at the time. I think Ayahasapani remembers it. They wanted a little quick teaching and I needed to go to the toilet. So I asked her, where's the monk's toilet? This is in the old cottage. And so I knew that because, you know, I was helped design it and just funded it and just, you know, was there before even Hasapanya went there. So, I knew where it was. Of course I knew where it was, been there many times. He said, and she was saying, over there, you see, on the door, toilet. Oh, yeah, yeah. So I went to the door with, no, I think, toilet on it, and I pretended to urinate on the door. I didn't really do it, you know, I didn't. But I just stood there and said, what are you doing? Well, you said it's toilet. I'm following your instructions. It says toilet. And you've got the word on there, toilet. So I'm just following the instructions. Just messing around, trying to get a teaching, which is, you know, just a bit weird. Actually, quite weird. But so it could be memorable. They went, no, what are you talking about? The toilet's inside. Well, why didn't you say that? Toilet inside. Water bottle. That's not water, it's not wet. You should say water. It says here, spring water. It's not wet at all. It's just yucky, I can't drink this. Inside. And what we're talking about there is something actually quite deep. Anicca. What is it? Oh, it's anicca. It's impermanence. It is change. It is. You've heard all this, haven't you? Do you understand it? So that's the trouble. The words, you can translate it to so many different languages. You can compare it and write an essay on the origins of anicca and what mindfulness really means, sati. Well, you're totally unmindful. So this is where sometimes the words can often stop us seeing the meaning. And of course, my favorite simile of that was the last story in the Good, Bad, Who Knows book. It was the professor of philosophy who went to the 5-star restaurant. Remember that one? So, professor of philosophy, He was, you know, very, very well-known lecturer in Kantian philosophy. That's pretty good, wasn't it, Kantian philosophy? I just don't know where that, I remember that one from. And anyway, Kantian professor of philosophy, and he liked his food, and so when in the university town someone had opened up a five-star restaurant, Michelin five stars. Wow. He made a booking as soon as he found out. Even though his professor, he had to wait a couple of months for his reservation to come up. And when the reservation came up, he dressed in a really fine suit. And he went to the restaurant, and there was a big maitre d', not a bouncer like a nightclub, but a maitre d'. And he said, "Sir, can I see your ID?" And he showed his ID. "Yes, sir. Professor, welcome. You got a reservation this evening." And they took him into the restaurant. And because it was a very expensive restaurant, the lighting was just subdued. Not like this place. But subdued. So it was light enough to find your way. But gave this ambience of like privacy and coziness. And when he got to his table, it was mahogany. With this incredibly comfortable seat, more like a Chippendale, music should go into some museum. And when there's just a little, some candles there, just so he could see when the waiter gave him the menu. And the menu was on this thick parchment. Not like you get in McDonald's, really a thick parchment with this gold filigree on the outside. And all of the things on the menu, they were written, first of all in French, and so you don't even quite know what you're eating, but in French, in calligraphy, even the menu was just beautiful. And so he thanked the waiter, and the waiter left him, and he looked at the menu, and then he ate the menu. And then he paid his bill and left. Because the professor did not understand the difference between the menu and the food. It's like someone who reads the Abhidhamma. And they argue, what's those things there for? It's for the food. What does it mean? So, when you get your food, you know the difference between the concepts and the reality. There's a purpose. Dear Ajahn, can you please speak about healing powers in meditation? Don't mean the calming of pain in meditation, but the actual physical healing. Yeah, sometimes when you get into deep meditation. I mean really deep meditation. Sometimes weird things happen. Oh, it's happened many, 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 many times. Okay, the healing power of meditation. Cancers. Why are you going quiet? Serious business, isn't it? So this person, this was in one of the retreats. It's actually what Buddha Dhamma many years ago. I gave a retreat there. And you know what happened? This fellow came in. First evening, question box. Question after question after question. Ajahn Brahm, can you please ask people to breathe quietly? That's a really weird question because this fellow was making a big noise. And so I made the announcement that that gentleman has got sinus cancer. He's got this huge tumor on the top of his nose because he checked in with me before when he first came. And he said, his doctors have only given him a short time to live. No more treatment possible. He's tried everything. And still this huge tumor in his top of his nose. That's why he can't breathe. And as soon as I said that, it was amazing because when people were just so kind, that the breathing never bothered them anymore. Isn't that fascinating that people can make a noise, they can bang your doors, or they can get up in the early morning and just make a cup of tea and just tinkle, tinkle, tinkle with the cup. But when you find out why they're doing that, sometimes all the anger and the negativity disappear when you understand. So anyway, as soon as I said that, he would just get so much metta, compassion for people. They didn't mind him snoring because he was giving this a last chance before, you know, he died, do some meditation. And of course, I tell that story. I only tell the good stories, not when it doesn't work. But for him, you know, he came running towards me just as I was in the car going to the airport. He came running towards me. It's amazing why these people always do it at the very last minute. It's the point to that. And so he came running towards me and said, Ajahn Bhav, just the last meditation, I heard a popping sound in my nose. Pop. And I could breathe through my nose. Coming out of that for months. It lasted about 1 minute and then it closed up again. But you know, that was not imagining it. He could actually feel it. It was there. He could breathe and then it closed up again. And he got so excited. I was, getting in the car, going to, trying to get to the airport to come back to Perth. And so, you know what I said to him? Something like, very good, carry on. I said that to everybody. But, you know, I really meant it, but I thought that, you know, he was left it too late. I thought he was going to die. But of course, I tell that story because 6 months later or a year later, this guy came to see me and he said, do you remember me? Now, he did really look totally different than when he had this cancer in his nose. And I said, no. He said, I was that fella. Full remission. No more tumor. Thank you so much for teaching me that meditation. Now, what he said, I'm going to spend the rest of my months alive on this planet teaching other people how to do this. I haven't seen him since. I don't know where he's gone, but it's wonderful that it worked for him. And, you know, it's not imagination. You know, you can imagine just a pain disappearing, but imagining a cancer, it's just gone. So, it does work. But if you start to think, get out of here, you don't belong, I don't want your cancer, come on, go. I've been meditating for 3 days now and you still haven't gone. That's not what meditation is, just learning how to relax to the max and these things disappear. Great. Robert, you've been encouraging us to listen to what our body mind wants, which is wonderful, but then you also said that any kind of wanting is a cause of suffering and rebirth. The second noble truth instructs us to abandon wanting. So how can we reconcile these different messages around wanting? Ask your body what it needs. It's like kindness, compassion, loving kindness to your body, being a friend to your body. It's not wanting to control it. That's the craving which leads to rebirth. The wanting to do this and do that and get results. This is kindness. It's not wanting, it's opening the door of your heart to your body and listening to it. It's a difference between caring and curing. Caring is heals things, makes you friends. Care for your body, care for your mind. Not curing it, that's controlling wanting, wanting it to be different, improving it. Caring for it. Caring is compassion, kindness. Curing is wanting it to be different. That's the difference. Care for your body. Care for your mind. Where does patience come from? I'm fed up with that question. I don't want to tell you I'm patient. I don't know how many times people have asked me that patience question. And it was there are two types of patience. The first type. Look, you know, when you have to answer questions all day, sometimes I get a bit impatient. So I want to make a bit of fun, make it a bit lively, just for myself, not anybody else. So where does patience, there are two types of patience. The first patience is waiting for something to happen. I've been sitting here all day. Nothing's happened. You said nimittas will come. It hasn't happened. That's called waiting in the future. Waiting for something to happen. That's not patience. What really is patience is waiting in this moment. Waiting in this moment. The idea is, you know, you're teaching Pali now, you're doing well. You know what the patient is? It's like the accusative case, isn't it? The patient. Yeah. what receives. It's not the actor, it's the recipient. That's just grammar. So it's just the English language. I know some people, as soon as I mention the word grandma, you think, what's my grandmother got to do with this? This is English, sometimes the structure of speech, and especially just why that word patient is actually meant. It's just being on the receiving end, not the doer, just the knower, the patient, not the actor. That's one of the greatest parts of patience. Be the patient, not the doctor, not the doer, but the receiver, the knower. Ajahn Brahm, with walking meditation, where are your hands supposed to be? Where's the place for your hands? Usually on your head. I was going to do that later on, but the nuns are not here yet, anyway. But they're all here. Yeah, wherever they're comfortable, basically. Does being kind to the body contradict with the practice of the 32 parts of the body? Practices? Are the 9 channel ground contemplations useful? Okay, this is part of the body awareness in the Satipatthana Sutta and also the Kayagati Sutta. That's the mindfulness of the body. But how many parts of the body are there in the Satipatthana Sutta? 32 parts or 31 parts? It's 31 parts of the body. It is the commentary makes it 32, but the original in the Buddha was only 31 parts. You know why? Because in the original, they didn't include the brain. The original 31 parts was a no-brainer. It was. And then they realized, this is deep meaning to this. Because in the commentaries, in the Abhidharma, they added the brain. Because, you know, to people so peaceful in the suttas, you know, all this thinking brain business wasn't really relevant. But afterwards, then they got and they recognized it was a brain, and all hell got let loose, and so many concepts and ideas in those commentaries. But it doesn't really matter, 31 parts, 32 parts, 36 parts, or however many parts. All that really was understanding this body is not sort of really important. You know, you care for it, look after it, but you don't celebrate it and just worry about who's got the most beautiful body or the most ugly body. This body is a body, that's all. So, for the new novices, we did a novice ordination the other day, I have to say it again, they always give these five contemplations. Hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth and skin. That's been a tradition for years for female ordinations, male ordinations. So what do you do that for? What's the purpose of that? Why is that so important? It's because these are usually young men and young women. They'll become novices, the first stage of ordination. They usually got sensual desire, especially towards the other gender. So this is supposed to protect them. How? Well, who's the most attractive, say, woman now? Who's the young guys? Who is, come on, admit it, who's the hottest chick? That, don't say Mother Teresa. She's a good woman. I don't know, who is, in my... I don't know, Angelina Jolie. I don't know, but that's a long time ago, isn't it? Who is it? She's okay now. Who's the top supermodel? Taylor Swift. Yeah? Okay, a few people say okay. So, guys, imagine you see Taylor Swift coming in here, in the room. She's a meditator. But she comes in here. What would you do? Would you go, wow? Look at her. What do you think? Hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, because that's all you can see. There's hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth and skin. So you look at her and you say, the hair of the body and the hair of the head. It's all dead stuff, isn't it? Because, you know, the roots are underneath the skin. Nails. You can't see anything alive in there. It's just all dead. Teeth. The root is inside. You can't see the root of the teeth. Skin. This is all dead stuff. It all flakes off. That's where the dust comes from. This is all dead stuff here. So, when, you know, underneath is the live stuff. Now maybe a millimeter, 2 millimeters underneath the skin. That's where the life bit is. But on the outside, this is all dead. So, you see her. Dead hair, dead teeth, dead skin. Who would want to even touch that, let alone kiss it? That's sick. What is doing? I don't know, what about the girls? Who's the hot guy these days? Okay, you say, Chris, my husband. That's a husband. Whoever it is, but it's the same. You look at somebody, not like, I don't mind saying that now, that there was, remember Judy, she passed away. She told me the story. She went to pay respects to His Holiness the Dalai Lama up in Dharamsala, not Dharamsala, Dharamsala, over in India. And had to wait 3 or 4 or 5 days to see him, get an audience. And so in the morning, she had a meditation room. She was meditating there in the mornings. And she meditated there one morning. And she told me, a very funny woman, really sort of a great girl, Judy Rushforth. And so she's sitting there. And she heard someone sit next to her, you know, another meditator. And so she just, you know, just must have been a bit distracted. She certainly wasn't in jhana. And it's also certainly not afterwards, because she looked at Richard Gere, sit next to me. Richard Gere, come on, watch your breath, breathe again, breathe again. And I'm, oh, Richard Gere. And that wrecked her whole meditation. What she should have done, Richard Gere, hair of the head, hair. That's all it is. So that's one of 32 parts. It's just a body, that's all. What you add to it. It's the problem. What is the purpose of chanting? It's just the idea is, sometimes as monks, we do lots of chanting, blessing chanting, getting healing chanting, getting rid of ghost chanting, and we're really famous for getting rid of ghosts. We're very effective, and the reason is because if you hear our chanting, no self-respecting ghost can stand it. So they run as fast as they can to get away. Now, it started off, the chanting was started off to be able to chant as remembering the teachings. So when there weren't any books, there weren't any iPads, you know, you'd remember them by heart. And that's why, that, you know, if you know your Sampali, because I must admit, the English translation is okay, but when you get into the original Pali, you know what that means. That's powerful sometimes. So I remember many times there's another metta chant. Metancha sahagatena achetasa. And it was, that chant was just so powerful when we used to do it. I couldn't finish it. You got sort of halfway through it and, you know, just, I knew what I was chanting. I started chanting metta all over the place. And it just got so blissed out, I had to stop and just wait for everyone else to finish what I was blissing out, sending loving kindness all over the place. Because, you know, when you're doing it, you understand what's happening, and it's powerful, powerful stuff. The same way some of the other chanting we do, like the Dhammacakka Sutta, the first sutta, wow, that is really, really very deep. The Anattalakkhana Sutta, non-self. You know, when you chant that and you really know what you're chanting, it's like hearing the Buddha teach. And it really gets into you. And it's great Dhamma. So that's what the original part of chanting was. But these days it's more like priestcraft sometimes. So when sometimes people, they invite you to a funeral, do some chanting for the funeral. You know, sometimes say, how much do you charge? We don't charge anything. This is not a business. And so they say, oh, we don't charge anything, you can't be any good, we're going to ring up the other temple. Sometimes that's what it is. And so the chanting was originally for something else. Anyway, at a retreat like this, how many hours should I try seated meditation? 24 a day. Keep it natural. When is the best time to meditate? Now, yes. When is the worst time to meditate? Later. In other words, keep it in the present moment. Later on is the worst time. Thank you for sharing the use of teddy bears to cultivate metta in our hearts. How were you inspired to develop and share bear awareness? I think you would really enjoy the movie titled Ted. Have you ever watched it? No. What is Ted? Much too short for teddy bear, I suppose. But anyway, how it happened was actually the first time was in Hong Kong when I went to do a teacher retreat there. And this very, very smart gentleman, he bought two teddy bears and he put them on the shrine next to the Buddha to be blessed. And just after a while, people looked at us and said, can I cuddle it, please? And so they cuddled it. And then had to share it with somebody else. And by the end of the retreat, those bears were so well loved. With some very wealthy people, I offered this gentleman a huge amount of money for them. He said, nope. They wanted to take them home with them. And from that, I saw a business opportunity. Great spots of Dhammasama somewhere. So these bears are just, you know, very, very powerful. And you can borrow them. And sometimes, you know, the really nice ones, you know, we keep for a little while and use them for raise money for the nuns' monastery or something. I never use it for myself, so I must be careful about that. And so, but then people started using them. And then after a while, they just, so quickly, they vanished. And then other ones replaced them because they work. And it's because many people are just too hard on themselves. You know, they think they don't deserve happiness, or they're not good enough. And they're just too forceful. And some which is soft, which generates loving kindness so easily, is a huge addition to the meditation practice. That's why we have many here. So, quite frankly, that if you find one you really, really like, you want to take it home with you, fine. But you can send another one back, or another two next time. Because it's important that, you know, these aren't there just for show, they're to be used. Could you please explain how does karma work? How can one reduce negative karma and increase positive karma? What does intention play in karma? That karma is intention. Intention is karma. So if you don't mean to do it, it's not karmically active. But just because, you know, that you step on something, but, you know, you didn't know what you were doing, because, you know, your mind was elsewhere, then, of course, there's no karma. You have to be intentional, knowing what you're doing. And, of course, the more the intention, the more deliberate it is, the more intense is the karma. So, you know, if, you know, you just, you know, because you're texting somebody, you ram into somebody's car, you know, that's still just heedless. If you deliberately, I don't like this person, and you try and ram them, that's much heavier karma. So that's just an understanding about the karma. Because a lot of times people don't know what they're doing, especially when they're young. When you get more elderly, just more mature, more understanding, then it can be very bad. And even, interestingly, monks and nuns, if you do an act, and lay people do an act, the karmic response is much greater for monastics than it is for lay people. And it was explained that somebody who's riding a horse compared to riding on an elephant's back. If you fall from a horse, yeah, you hurt yourself. If you fall from an elephant, that's much higher, you hurt yourself more. They said, no, for Sangha, being ordained, like you're riding on an elephant. So if you make a mistake, it hurts more. Got greater karmic consequences. It's interesting, but you know, you can see that that's true. Anyway, karma is a big thing which I'll maybe mention later on. Is it possible to use my meditation practice to ease the fear and gain confidence in public speaking? Yeah, sure. I can speak about anything. I don't have fear, even though I speak a lot of rubbish sometimes. You know, sometimes it's amazing. With confidence is the key. Because sometimes people ask me, what was it? That's right, it was in the Duxton Hotel when it was just opened. I went there, there was a transport conference. Now, Alana McTiernan, she was organizing it because I knew her. Now, she wanted me to be a member of the public and know about transport. And unfortunately, they were talking all sorts of stuff, you know, in the morning. And by the time they had for lunch, it was about 12:15. I missed my lunch because I have to eat before noon. So just, okay, it doesn't matter. I can just sit down and just do some meditation. But I was sitting down there and this gentleman came up and said, oh, you know, can I interview you? I said, for what? It was a shipping magazine. And I wasn't doing anything. Okay, we'll talk about anything. So he asked me all these questions about, you know, the transport benefits of shipping. This is absolutely true. And yeah, okay, I don't mind. So, and then afterwards, you know, I just rabbited on for half an hour like I usually do. And then, you know, he said, oh, thank you very much, very good. And so I never saw him about 9 months later. I saw him somewhere and he said, oh, you know, remember that article, you know, or that interview I did? You know, I called it Zen and the Art of Shipping. You know, that's not really original. But he said, Zen and the Art of Shipping by Ajahn Brahm. He said, you wouldn't believe just how well that was received. It went to every major shipping journal in the world. And you know, I said, don't believe, but it's true. And he said, he got all these emails back. He said, who's this Ajahn Brahm? Who's this Ajahn Brahm? We'd never heard of him before, but he certainly knows about shipping. And that was absolutely true. So just have confidence. And yeah. Sometimes I just wonder just what's going on here. But I do know about my meditation and Buddhism. I don't sort of know that is real. So yeah, it does see your fear of going confidence in public speaking. Just you don't care what people think of you. Because when I started public speaking, I thought only two options can happen. Either, you know, people like your talks. That's wonderful. Great opportunities to share the Dharma to others. Or they get so bored, I don't need to give any talks again. I know there's one of the monks, he's upset so many people when he's given public talks that he's much smarter than I am, so he doesn't have to go and give talks anymore. He stays in monastery all the time. People say, oh, please don't send that monk anymore. So smart. Anyway, no, just out of kindness, you give talks. So I have been avoiding public speaking, but as my career progresses, it's becoming obvious that I have to get used to it. I understand there's no alternative to practice and just putting myself out there and take the opportunity to speak publicly. You're only speaking to one person. It's amazing that people can chat and yarn for such a long time, talking over, you know, a coffee table, talking about all sorts of things. So just relax, just talking with your friends. That's all it is. However, the moment I have to speak in front of a group that I am not familiar with, my heart rate goes up and the nervousness affects my mental clarity. How can I use mindfulness meditation to help me in this process? Thank you. Number one, just start off with a story, a joke. Have a few jokes at hand. And this, because when you laugh and they laugh, everyone gets just... Oh, that is a very good question. Dear Ajahn, please read the question slowly. Right. this is the first warning. Good. You see what karma is? What I say comes back to me. Ajahn, in Digha 23 with Payasi, Kassapa implies that the sun and moons are gods. Nonsense. Do the sun and moon have mind? 31 planes of existence, 31 dimensions or more. Are you familiar with the many worlds theory, universe branching off with every choice made? That's a sort of totally different thing. Imagine in those ancient days, you know, the people did worship the moon, did worship the sun. So they didn't know that they were gods. They didn't know that the moon was made of cheese. And so that people had ideas. This was written at that time. And so people didn't really know what it was like. But there were other places which were really inspiring because they said that there was the first astronaut, the first man in space. What was his name again? Rohitasa. It was in the sutras. Remember, I warned you, if I ask a question. So Rohitasa, he was this monk, and he developed these psychic powers to be able to levitate. But, you know, he was Olympic standard levitator, so he left the atmosphere because he wanted to find out, you know, where the universe ends. You know, if there was the end to the universe. So he travelled, how they described it, to where the moon and the sun shine not. In other words, beyond, you know, the light of the sun. Which was amazing, must have been quite a long, the idea that, you know, that dark space existed. And surprise, surprise, he died on the journey before he found the end of the universe. So, when he came back, you know, in the next life, that's right, after he died on the journey, in his next life as a god, minor god, he went to just ask, you know, the first layer of gods, well, where does the earth, where does the universe end? And they said, we don't know, go to the next level of gods, and then go to the next level of gods, and eventually worked his way up to Brahma, you know, and he said, oh, I've been looking for you, where does the universe end? And God said, I am God, the firstborn, the creator, the powerful, the beginning, the end, the Alpha and Omega. He said, yeah, I know, but I never asked you that. Where? This is a bit cheeky. In some places I'll be crucified for that, but, you know, this is that season for crucifying people, so... So anyway, where does the universe end without remainder? And then he said, I am the great God. He said, yes, I know. But where does the universe end without remainder? And the God pulled him aside. And he said, because he was a monk, he's in a monk's form because he died as a monk. He said, listen, I don't know. But everybody else think I'm God and omniscient. And I know everything. Please don't spoil my reputation. But he said, it's in the Digha Nikaya, what God didn't know. And he said, and anyway, you just made a big mistake, monk. Over in Earth, in the Ganges Valley, there is a person called the Buddha. Ask the Buddha, he will know. And so he appeared in front of the Buddha and said, where does the Earth, where does the universe end? And that's where the Buddha said a famous saying, you can find the end of the universe within this body of mind, this fathom-long body of mind. We know the last part of the story, the end, beginning and end of the universe is in this body of mind. A really great little story. So please don't take offense, but you did ask for it. 31 planes of existence. Anyway... Devachan Brahm, why is fear and anxiety that I experience in dream, in nightmares, different than any fear I experience in real life? The one in dream is much more dark. Wow. I think it's probably because that when you're awake, you've got sort of more power control to just, you know, avoid it or move away from it or find procedures to be able to escape from that fear. But if it's in a dream, it's like a little bit out of control. You know, you have a little bit of control, but not much. So that's why in a dream, it's number one, it's karmically not effective, whatever you do in that dream. And number two, it is, in the dream, it's what you really take into the dream with you. So it's only fearful if you go to sleep, you know, with a bit of fear before you go to bed. So usually, if you don't want the fearful or anxious dreams, then just give yourself a resolution. Before you go to bed, I will have a good night's sleep. That usually works. Programming your mindfulness. Two questions left. If... Crikey, is this? Okay, it's one question, two pages. Dear Ajahn, it was so nice to talk to you about monastic intentions this morning. Mostly I've been feel good and positive. After talking to you, it was like a dam burst. Grief came in devastating ways. At times I remember to be open, remember Dhamma, and it passed. I feel sure of my path, but still I'm feeling the pain of what I'm willingly seeking to give up. I may not last the distance of monastic life, and that's okay, but I have to try, even if it means giving up a loving friend. But right now I feel my retreat, which is normally a wonderful experience, is somewhat wrecked. Will those waves of grief continue to follow me into the monastery? How is it possible to move through this and still be open and present? I feel I'm crazy to renounce and also feel nuts. That was like the story... Oh, I think we still got the cartoon. Is it still in the dining room? The squirrel? The squirrel going to the psychiatrist? Still there? Okay, yeah. Squirrel in the psychiatrist's couch. What are you doing here, squirrel? Well, as soon as I heard you are what you eat, I realized I was nuts. So that's one way, because when you have thoughts of grief, it's like the hand comes right in front of you and you think that's all there is. Whether you try, you don't try, after a while, the hand comes out here. And you see things in perspective. Yeah, you're giving up something, but you're also gaining a lot. So the grief just starts to disappear. And after a while, if it really, monastic life is really what is for you, when you first enter it, of course you have a little bit of doubt, and am I ready for this? This is the right thing to do. But the nice thing about Buddhist monastic life is that you can leave at any time. So it's always temporary ordination. My temporary ordination is still going. It's been 43 years, yeah, but you know, one day I'm going to die, so it's all temporary ordination. Now, what that really means, it takes away a lot of the fear when there's an exit strategy. So it's not like a one-way, once you're in, you're caught, like, you know, in a trap. So instead, what it means is, yes, you get into monastic life and you see if it's for you. You can always leave at any time. And that means you only stay in monastic life because you enjoy it, because it's fun. And you find you get so much support from your loved ones. They think it's a wonderful thing you're doing. There are many people who are doctors and nurses and businessmen and politicians, but for Sangha, monastics, I mean, good ones, they're very rare in this world. So rare that, you know, monks like me get invited all over the place. You know, sometimes they get invited to Sri Lanka. We invited me to Sri Lanka for? There's thousands of monks there. They're like, you know, bringing coal to Newcastle. But we need more monks and nuns to share the workload and actually to, because it's obviously very powerful. You know, and it's not sometimes people say, well, there's many lay meditation teachers. But they've got a totally different level of renunciation, of giving up. That's why, you know, the monks who really renounce, nuns who really renounce, they're really quite special. So because of that, it's a wonderful thing to do, but you give it a try. And of course, my own story, it was unexpected, because I always thought, I'll just become a monk, temporary ordination in Thailand, maybe a year, 2 years. You know, I had a job at a school teaching physics, and the head of the department said, oh, you know, we really like you here. When you come back, please let us know, so we'll give you your job back. So I had no job security, just go over to Thailand, become enlightened, and then go back and carry on with my work and my family. Another thing to get out of the way, tick off my box. That's how much I understood about what monastic life was and what enlightenment was. As soon as I became a monk, I tell the monks this story, and it's absolutely accurate. I had my nightmares. First, after ordination, just as a novice monk, at first, I had nightmares for the first 4 or 5 nights. Wake up in a sweat in this Wat Saket in Bangkok. And my nightmare was, I was a layman. And I opened my eyes, really afraid, and I saw my robes neatly folded next to my bed. And this was totally, obviously unpremeditated. You can't really control much when you first wake up in the morning. You're not quite sure where you are. And I saw those robes. I'm a monk. I've made it. Yeah. And I closed my eyes, went into a deep sleep. That happened about, 3 or 4 nights in a row. And that was telling me something very, very deep. But this is what I really always wanted to do. And after that, I've only been a monk 5 or 6 days, and I told everybody I'm in this for life. I said, I know many people say that. How can you tell? The future is uncertain. You know, sometimes you know what you're going to do. It just fits you. This is what you always were meant to be or whatever. But certainly I felt so comfortable, and that insight was very strong. And so far, so good. 43 years. So that's actually just, you don't know until, I could never predict that when I was a layperson. Never realized this, you know, how much you wanted to become a monk and how it was really inside of you. So that's why it's nice to give it a try. And these days, having ordained many, many people over those years, that I admit I can't tell. Someone comes to ordain, and I think, wow, an amazing candidate. And other people come to ordain and say, oh, this is a hopeless case. What am I ordaining this person for? And the one I think is really going to make it for all the qualities they describe. And the ones I think is a no-hoper, they become great monks. And so, honestly, I can't tell nuns who's going to really be a great nun, you know, who is going to just be a pain in the... you can't... So because of that, you give everyone a chance. And some of the people I give a chance to, I thought would never make it, and they're just so proud of them. They've really done well out of it. Good on you. So these days, give everyone a chance. Literally everyone. See what happens. Why not? Criminals. Angry Mala became a monk. He became such an amazing monk. People who were mad. Patachara. And out of her mind, he came into the temple in front of the Buddha totally naked. And the other monks, no, get out of here, you know, just. And the Buddha said, no, let her come in. And, you know, totally badly dressed. Can't get more badly dressed than that in front of the Buddha. And so they put a robe around her, and she became the most amazing teacher. And that was, you know, when I just read, you know, in my own time, just wasn't forced, wasn't studied in a sort of a lecture theatre, the Terigata, the verses of the enlightened nuns. And I was reading it through, and they said, and it's an interesting story, because that these nuns, they said, oh, we've been meditating for years, and then this great teacher came along, and they taught us how to meditate, and next week we're totally enlightened. And this was story after story after story. you know, nuns had been ordained for 10, 20 years, and then just this one teacher came along and taught them how to meditate properly, and they were just, and they really got it really quickly. And so I went, where was this teacher? It was Padachara. This woman who had lost her parents, her children, two children and her husband on the same day, and it just went out of her mind. And the Buddha allowed her to come in and, you know, taught her the Dhamma, and she became one of the greatest teachers ever. People like, you know, you just meditating how many years, and then you get the right teacher comes in and wow. So she was really just amazing, that Padachara. So, yeah, that can be you. Anyway, yeah, I'll get myself inspired. So anyway, let's do the three sadhus, and then we can go and get a rest. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Well, the other thing about stuff, I did mention, why is it that, you know, that fellow who had the cancer, why was it the very last meditation that something happened, the cancer shrunk? Because trying so hard, the last meditation, nothing was working, so he just gave up. Relax. Always remember that. Sometimes, many of you may go to bed now, and just meditate all day, just lay back, and you get limiters come up. Why? Because now you're not expecting them. I've ruined it for you tonight now. But because you don't expect it, it means that you let go, and then these things happen. So you can understand that the problem with trying and expecting stuff, that's the biggest hurdle. Anyway, have a good night. You're not going to get anything tonight because I've warned you about it. Now they might.